Three mates, three headlines, what's next?
Episode 12, boys, and what a reaction we had to last week's episode with Rob Elliott. Once again, ever so grateful to Rob for his time and insight that he afforded us, but also the support we have received from the listeners. As always, very appreciative, but on to this week. And firstly, as always, how are we both? Is there any news for me?
Yeah, good, thanks, mate. Heart rate's just about getting back to normal from Newcastle's nine men heroics. On Saturday against Southampton. Jeff Hendrick doing everyone a favour by getting sent off nice and early.
Sure. Yeah, not a bad week. Had the challenge with the snow up north again. I'm sure you've seen Doig, and the less we speak about Liverpool, the better. I'm sure you're going to bring it up at some point, though.
I won 160 quid on that game. I forgot to mention this. Betting's finally come good. Had a little bet builder on. Salah to have a shot on target. Gundogan to have a shot on target. Fabinho to be booked. Salah to have two shots in total. And then there was something else in there, but no one really cares. 160 quid, my back pocket. Dreamy.
Know when to walk away, Jimmy. Anyway, on to this week. And we'll start with our headlines. Another busy week. And there are so many good stories in here this week. So we'll start with football. In Leeds, they signed a pitch from Spurs. Lingard scored twice in his debut. John McGinn went after Sean Dyche's coach. And Hamilton sacked their commentator for taking a Barry whilst on commentary. The team win with no recognised centre-backs on the pitch. Liverpool lose twice in the week to Brighton and Man City, which left Klopp blaming Alisson's cold feet for the latest defeat. Mark Wright's got his first start for Crawley at left-back. He was pulled off at half-time with the team 3-0 down, prompting the manager to describe the performance as farcical. And in cock-up of the week, Ajax have managed to leave out record signing Sebastian Haller from their Europa League squad due to an admin oversight, despite spending £20 million on him. Cricket. The Sixers won the Big Bash thanks to James Vince and his 90-odds to go back-to-back, as Josh Felipe won player of the tournament. Australia cancelled their test series in South Africa, meaning all eyes are on their white ball series in New Zealand instead. Kyle Matters scored a fourth innings unbeaten double ton on debut to help the West Indies chase 395 to beat Bangladesh. And in this week's instalment of Liam Livingstone news, he was told by an Aussie in the crowd that if he was any good, he would be playing in India, where, of course, England have won the first test by 227 runs. In rugby, Scotland turned over England at Twickenham. Wales beat Ireland and France pump Italy, leading to more calls for relegation from the Six Nations and Georgia to join the competition. Sale under Alex Sanderson to look a new team as they won again, beating Bristol. And in the lead up to the championship, Ealing Trailfinders turned Surrey's over again. The rest of the sporting world, Brooks won in Phoenix, DJ won in Saudi. Barneveld returns to darts to try and win a tour card at Q School. Kevin Durant had to be benched and was subsequently removed from the game due to NBA COVID protocol, prompting a free me tweet. Hamilton has signed a one-year extension at Mercedes. Sandhagen put in another UFC KO of the Year candidate with a knee to the head of Frankie Edgar. And in the Super Bowl, where a 30-second commercial would cost you £4 million, Tom Brady showed he is the true GOAT and one of sport's greatest athletes as the Bucks beat the Chiefs, meaning Jimmy was the only one to predict correctly last week. I bet you didn't put money on that one, Jimmy.
One on the board. Who cares about American football?
Any thoughts on any of those, boys? That is a lot of news. There's some good stories.
There. I had some at the start, but I'm not going to lie. I've completely forgotten. So if you would run through the football again, that'd be ideal. But don't worry if it's not.
The only two, I think the two cock-ups of which one ever is bigger, that Sebastian Haller is great. I love how it's a little admin error, spending 20 million.
Prime football manager, that. Oh, you cannot pretend you've not accidentally left someone out.
Many occasions, then having to try and explain to them what I've done. And Mark Wright getting the start and them being 3-0 half time, completely missed that. But I don't know which one's more of a cock-up. Both big news, though.
Pulled off at half time, was he, Andy?
Yeah, that's what they reckon. Good half for him. Good half.
Michelle's been busy, hasn't she?
Never mind. We'll sharply move on, eh? Doiger, I think you've got another headline up. So what's next?
Yeah, a few weeks ago, you may recall that rugby in England had a couple of weeks off whilst European fixtures were cancelled. And during that time, I got to sit down with Gallagher Premiership referee Christoph Ridley to talk officiating and rugby. seeing as this week was the first round of fixtures in the Six Nations, now seems an apt time to release that interview. So this week, my headline act is professional rugby referee Christoph Ridley. Christoph, firstly, thank you so much for joining us. As ever, while things are as they are, how are you doing? How are you finding this latest lockdown 3.0?
Yeah, fine. So a bit like everyone else, when the first lockdown came in, I started to bake. I posted it every single bake I did on Instagram and people quickly got sick of that. I started to do a bit more training, but I think with this being the third one, you start to get a little bit tired of finding new things to do. So I think it's just a case of getting through this one and we just suck it up, try follow the rules as much as we can, and then hopefully we can crack on and get back to normal sometime soon.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we should say that one of the reasons you've joined us, and we are so grateful for your time, is that because there's been a bit of a lull, let's say, in the season, the European Challenge Games were cancelled, and you've been able to offer your time to various different outlets, lots of schools, lots of Zoom meetings, lots of webinars. And we reached out and you said you would give us 15, 20 minutes of your time. So we really appreciate you joining us on that. And I guess that is a nature of lockdown where there are gaps in the timetable. But first of all, if we can take it all the way back to the start for you with your rugby officiating, how did you get into refereeing and what does that route to the top involve, so to speak?
Okay, so the first thing to point out is obviously refereeing is a really strange thing to choose to do. It's just, it's not a thing that people think, wake up one day and decide, you know what, today I'd really like to be a referee. So it tends to be one of those things that you find yourself just falling into for some odd reason. And my reason is quite similar to most referees. I'm an injured player. And as we all say, you know, I would have played for the Lions, if not for injury. But because I got injured, I decided to be a ref instead. So it's that classic story of would have been the best player ever. So I have ended up becoming a referee as a result of not being able to play. And the reason for that was because I was involved in an academy and there was some interest in bringing people over from the playing side and making them into referees because there was a feeling that that could add value to games if you had guys who played the game out there with the whistle refereeing, and that the game product, the spectacle would improve as a result of having guys who really understand what rugby is about. So I was asked if I was interested, and initially, I hadn't really considered it, but I decided to give it a go because it wasn't likely I would go very far with coaching, given I hadn't played at a really high standard. And it's one of those things that once you start doing it, it's just addictive. You get the same pressures that players get. You get the same pressures that coaches get. It's just that your end goal is a little bit different to what theirs is.
I think it's interesting. And do you think you find that whole relationship, and I know you're saying you weren't necessarily at the top level and you are now refereeing at that top level, but that relationship is respected with the players, that you have a knowledge of the game. It's not textbook taught knowledge, if that makes sense as a terminology. Do you think players, certainly when you officiate their games at that level, they can recognise that your game understanding is far more natural than book understanding?
For sure. And I think you have a whole breed of referees now that have a really good read of the game. So I don't think we do produce referees that just referee law and don't understand or have a feel of what's the right thing for this game at this point in time. So I think we're in a good place in terms of officiating, especially domestically in the English Premiership, where we really do consider, whether teams deserve to be rewarded because of positive play and what needs penalising, what doesn't need penalising because it's not relevant or doesn't have an impact on the game. And it isn't black and white. The game is quite grey. So it does require, and the best referees in the world really do have that feel for the game. And that's what makes them the best referees, not the fact that they know the laws.
Is that an avenue that the RFU in particular, and possibly even World Rugby, are going to look into a little bit more? I know in cricket, which is a sport that I know quite well, there's a lot of ex-players come out of the game. They try and get them into umpiring quite quickly. As you say, coaches' jobs disappear very quickly, even if you have all the qualifications and the CV behind you. But a lot of players are now going into that umpiring, are they going to try and do that refereeing with rugby similarly?
It's been going on in rugby for a while now. You know, you had Glenn Jackson, Saracens became a referee. Nick Berry, Wasps, is one of the top referees in Australia, one of the top referees in the world now. You got Carl Dixon from Harlequins, who's doing extremely well, and he's been involved in international rugby recently. So it's a recognised pathway that if you've played the game at the top level, there's opportunities for you if you decide to pick up the whistle. And as we said, you're halfway there because you've got that skill set and understanding. So transferring those skills over to the dark side of refereeing is good for them, and it helps them. And that's why we've had so much success out of guys like Carl and Nick and Glenn.
I know there are often courses advertised encouraging people to go and attend a course to upskill themselves and learn the laws and how to enforce them, so to speak. But what about at a younger age? It's one of the things that you're probably tired of being asked about being the youngest referee in the Premiership game, etc. How can we get more young people and rugby enthusiasts into officiating?
I think the difficulty of being a young referee is that we all know you have to be pretty robust, pretty resilient being a referee. It's not a job that you take up in order to make lots of friends. Because there's always going to be one disappointed team at the end of a game, and it's not a job where you're always going to please people. So it's not necessarily, it doesn't market itself to young people. You know, we're part of the generation where we want instant gratification for everything we do. You know, we do any small act of kindness, and we don't just do it quietly. We tend to want it to be videoed or some sort of audit of it so that we can show people we've done this great thing. So we tend to want pats on the back as young people, and that's a generational thing. And it doesn't fit well in with refereeing, because when you referee well, people often don't talk about you. And that's the end goal for us, ultimately, is if we can come off the pitch at the end of the game and not be spoken about, then you're patting yourself on the back saying, well, I must have done a pretty good job because no one is saying anything about me. And I can't think of many roles out there, especially in sports, where ultimately you know that you've been pretty clinical and done a pretty good job because nobody is saying a word. So it's so unique in that essence. And as I say, it doesn't market itself that well to the needs of young people. So what I would say is that if you are young and you are a referee, you've got to come into this knowing that it's tough, and you need to be resilient and accept that it's not a game where people are gonna pat you on the back every single week. It's something you do because you enjoy first, and then something you do because you find out you're pretty good at it, and there are opportunities later in your career.
At the top level of the sport and officiating in the Gallagher Premiership, what does game day look like for you, and what pre-game preparation is involved?
I get the same nerves the players get. I sit there in the changing room, catastrophizing, worrying about what could possibly happen. And part of me thinks that we have more to worry about than the players, because the players have trained in the week. They've practiced set moves. And they are really in control of their own fate, in that they decide what they do when they're on the ball. They decide what they do when they're going to clear out, tackle, whatever. Whereas the referee's role is very reactive. I can only perform based on what's put on in front of me. So I can do all the preparation in the world, but my fate ultimately is in the hands of what the players decide to bring. And if they bring really awkward scenarios and really gritty games, then we kind of get pulled into that. And so a lot of the perception around our performance will be around the quality of the game that's provided by the players. So that's the bit that I find tricky and makes me nervous, is that I'm not really in control of my own destiny, in the sense that I can only be reactive. I can't really train for and be proactive. I can prepare, but it will never be exactly what I've prepared for.
One of the greatest assets rugby has, and I don't know if that's the correct term or not to call it an asset, but that's the effective and respected use of the TMO to get the right decision at key moments in fixtures. And especially considering football seemingly have a flashpoint nearly every week at the moment, you work with the TMO daily, weekly. What makes that TMO system so effective and successful within rugby?
So I think in rugby, we've recognised we know the identity of the TMO. We know exactly what we use the TMO for. And essentially, it's to make sure that there aren't game-changing decisions missed. So they are a parachute for the referees. They sweep up the stuff that's really big and wouldn't be understandable if it was missed. Football is going through this teething period now where they've obviously not worked with the VAR for that long. And they're going through, I mentioned identity at the start, where they're not actually sure what they want out of the VAR. I'm not talking about the referees. I'm talking about the spectators, the commentary, and everyone involved in the game. And the reason I say that is because I see criticism when VAR calls an offside and the player's, you know, toe is offside. Well, if you introduce technology and he's, by a matter of fact, offside, then he's offside. So that's part and parcel of introducing the technology. You get the minutia. But then people say, well, that's not really right. It should be clearly offside. Well, then the more you muddy the water, the more difficult the involvement and what you want out of the technology can add to the game. So I think they're in this period of, do we want to be super clinical and accurate with all of the outcomes and get the toenails that are offside? Or do we want to get rid of technology and just get the big ones, which is what they were doing before when the linesmen were making the decisions? So I think they just have to decide which one they want, but you can't choose both.
Do you have moments when you're out on the field where it's a game-changing decision and it's almost that much of a, I'm thinking sort of, try, pile of bodies, pick and goes, all sorts of things, and you probably can't see a thing and you're just thinking, thank goodness I've got the TMO to fall back on. And I know you've got to make a soft decision and a soft signal or whatever it might be, but actually 5 camera angles, 6 camera angles, someone else up there that I can have a conversation with and we can talk through it to make sure we get that game-changing decision right, yeah, is a far bigger parachute, as you say, comfort blanket than, goodness, this is just on me. I've got to make a decision quite quickly. I can't sit and think about this for however long. Is that something that you found yourself on occasion actually thinking, thank goodness for that, I'm going straight upstairs here?
I suppose it's a double-edged sword because it's more help and it's something that I don't rely on, so to speak. I want to get everything on field, but it's something that is a resource and it can help me if I do miss something. However, it does create an expectation. So fans, I think, expect us to get everything at times, and I think it doesn't give you that ability to make honest mistakes, because people will always have that assumption of, well, you could have watched the replay or the TMO could have come in at this point. So yes, it's a fantastic bit of technology for us to use, and we do use it well most of the time, and I'm thankful to have it there. However, it can be a sting in that the expectation is that we get absolutely everything, and the reality is that that is not going to happen.
Out on the playing field, two of the most talked about hot spots, so to speak, for refereeing decisions at the moment are the scrum and the breakdown, respectively. And how difficult are they nowadays to referee with so much going on, modern game changes and teams finding loopholes to try and get round the rules? And I'm thinking almost specifically that caterpillar ruck that has now become synonymous with Exeter almost.
I think the game is just more technical now than it's ever been. So you mentioned scrums. It used to be a case of, you know, you'd tell the guys to crouch down, they'd crouch down, and then they'd just smash into each other. It was a big pushing contest, and then the ball came away. But now it's so technical, it's so controlled, that we're looking at small details as to who lost their shape first, who won the engagement, and then gets go forward first. And that's where the game becomes a little bit trickier than I think it has been in the past. You mentioned caterpillar rucks. Look, these teams are world-class teams. It's their job to think of playing the game all the way to the edge of the laws. So that's always going to happen, and you can change the rules as much as you want. They're always going to get as close to the boundary as they possibly can, and they should. And that's why these are the best teams in the world, is because they're able to get those 1% advantages. And ultimately, that's what wins you Premiership finals. That's what wins you European finals.
I've done a little bit of refereeing in my role as a PE and games teacher, and I'll be the first to say that I get terrified for player safety and likely err on the side of caution on occasion with decision-making to try and uphold that duty of care, which I feel I probably have to as a teacher. But have there been any anxious moments for yourself when you've been out in the middle watching some of these monsters run at each other full on, and they don't hold back nowadays?
Yeah,
but...
And yeah, so what I would say firstly is that when you're sat in the stand and you're watching on TV, the game is hugely diluted. So when you see these collisions on TV and you think, oh, that's a big shot, I can guarantee you when you're stood on field and you're next to it and you can hear it and you can see the speed, it's a lot bigger than you think it is. And it's a bit like when you watch the 100-meter race on TV and you see Usain Bolt. You know he's running fast, but you don't get a true feel for how fast he's truly running unless you were stood alongside him trying to run with him. So it's the same with rugby, in that the collisions are just brutal. I would not want to be playing this game. And there's times when I look at some of the collisions and I think, there's no way these players are going to get up. That's it. It's over. Because they've just killed each other. That's it. And they do. And they stand up and they run off and they go to the next breakdown, and you realise how incredible these athletes are, how finely tuned they are, and how robust their bodies are. And it is remarkable, and they are a special breed, these rugby players, and it's amazing the collisions that they can handle.
They are certainly monsters of men. They are specimens, I think, is the term that gets thrown around quite a lot. Lastly, rugby as a whole is notorious for respect, and especially the respect that players show to referees. Are there any players that stand out to you that you really look forward to officiating because of your relationship with them? Or equally, are there any that you maybe don't look forward to seeing when it comes to a weekend?
Good question. So we have a really unique relationship with clubs, commentary, the press. It is not us versus them. We have dialogue. This week, we have a Zoom call amongst the referees and the directors of rugby, where we have a conversation about how the game looks. We have a discussion, and we present about how we're going to interpret certain changes that are constantly being introduced in the game. So it's transparent, and that goes on with the review process, the preparation process leading into each game. So we are constantly having conversations. So it's not a case of we do our thing, they do their thing. We are having conversations, and I can assure you the relationships are brilliant. And of course, there'll be emotive moments post-game. Of course, there'll be the odd flashpoint in the press or flashpoint in a post-match interview. But that's all part of it's part of what we love. And the reason why we get these flashpoints is because people care. And, you know, when I have a really poor game, which happens, I'm really angry after the game. And I don't express that, but I'm angry because I care. Likewise, the coaches, when they lose, they're angry because they care. Same with the players. And so it's not always roses, but we have a relationship, and the relationship is productive. And it means that we actually learn from each other, and we talk through issues of the game, and we help each other make sure that when the games are aired every weekend, you as a spectator are getting the best product you possibly can, because we're working together to make sure we can produce that.
Awesome. I think that is something, again, that just upholds the morals and the values of rugby, that there is that relationship. And I think, I'm sure it does happen across the board, but I think it's really important that that is documented as regularly as possible, that actually directors of rugby, referees, officials, governing bodies work together to ensure that they are putting out not just the best product, but the safest products. And actually they are trying to drive that game forward with everyone buying into what is going on out on that field.
Definitely. And and the apologies, because the answer is quite a corporate answer, but I assure you it's true. And not only is it true, it's authentic and it's sincere. And we have chats with these guys after the games. And it's pleasant, and you know, 99% of these people, they're decent people, and it's the same with the referees. They're decent guys and decent women, so we all have a really nice relationship. It's not just professional; it's civil and it's kind.
No, I think quite exactly that. And when it's so many people that are passionate about their sport, and they are all involved in rugby, be that as a coach, a player, an official, a CEO, whoever it may well be, everyone has that same end goal, and that is making sure that rugby is being shown in the best possible light. Definitely. And working together to make sure that people understand how laws are going to be interpreted, governed, and then they can almost maybe give a bit back and, oh, we were going to try this, would this be allowed type thing.
Yeah.
It leads to better Saturdays and Sundays and fixtures, and it certainly is, as always, as it has been for such a long time, been a very, very good watch. And I'm delighted. One of the things that I think is a real positive of lockdown, and I can say this slightly biased because I'm a sports fan, but actually the amount of sport that's on TV, because they've staggered kickoffs and whether they've gone BT 1, 2, 3, red button, whatever it might be, and you could see whoever you want to watch at whatever time, because everything is being televised, I think is a real plus for sport, and especially rugby, to give them that exposure moving forward. So,
and you asked at the start about lockdown, and I forgot to mention that personally, we've been extremely lucky that sport has continued, and we've been able to go out and have purpose and do things other than just stay at home. And I know lots of people have got things that they'll worry about at the moment, and kids to look after at home, and a lot of sort of difficulties going on. So I do fully appreciate the position we're in, and we are very, very lucky. But yeah, you're right. Sport, it's been great to have sport back on the TV, and it's nice to be part of that as well.
For sure. Christoph, thank you so much for your time, your insight, your stories, and we look forward to the return of rugby in England and the Premiership at the weekend, and after that break, and with that, seeing you back out there officiating rugby games impeccably, as you can do. We'll speak to you soon. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Andrew. Thanks. Speak soon.
Cheers. Speak to you soon. Awesome insight as ever. And without muddying waters too much or moving away from rugby, I think what Christoph says about the use of TMO is exactly where football needs to be looking to get things right with VAR in a week where there were a couple of decisions that have subsequently been overturned. But did any of you catch any of the rugby over the weekend? What are your thoughts on the Six Nations from the opening fixtures?
Didn't catch any of the games individually to watch. I caught obviously some of the results, etc., but not much to add.
I watched a little bit of the England game. I was late to the start because the Newcastle game was obviously running late with all the additional time to kick off, and I had more interest in that. But the one thing I did pick up, a few of my mates were talking about the taking of the knee at the start with the Scotland-England players and some of the officials. I missed it. Couldn't quite wrap my head around what they were saying. Any insight?
Yeah, I think there has been a little bit about it. To be honest, as the game was being played out, I hadn't even realised that that had been a storyline that sort of subsequently came out Sunday, Monday. I think what it is, it's come from World Rugby. They haven't necessarily put out a stance on how they want teams to observe a taking of a knee or not in support of the Black Lives Matter movement for the Six Nations, as they did for the Autumn Nations Cup. And so when they were doing their anthems, or when they were just walking out onto the pitch and they'd lined up in their team formation, some players took to the knee, some players didn't. Scotland hadn't briefed their players on what they were doing, and so a couple of the players did take to a knee because they felt that was the right thing to do, and so one or two people either side of them took to the knee as well. But I don't know whether you've seen it, how far they are spaced out for whatever reason in rugby, despite them having scrums, rucks and mauls where they're all diving on top of each other. When they walk out to the pitch, the two teams pretty much take up the 100 yards of the pitch. So you can't necessarily see what your teammate's doing 10 people down, because he might well be 25 metres away. So it looked like some people did, some people didn't. Both nations have come out naturally and said that they obviously support the movement. Players are allowed to mark it in their own respective ways, and they'll continue to work with charities. So I think it was possibly people looking for a reason to go at Scotland after they'd just turned England over. And I don't think there's a huge amount in that. But on the game, what did you think of the game, Jimmy, when you caught up with it?
Finn Russell's in the wrong sport. He should be playing footy. Should be in the midfield for Rangers. Bloke has got a boot on him.
Yeah, well, if he is not playing 10 for the Lions come the summer or come that tour, it's going to be something else. I think what it showed is that Farrell probably showed some people, me included, that he's probably not even the best 10 for England. And especially when you look at him and his Sarri's teammates who haven't been playing, they looked undercooked. Vunipola looked heavy, looked slow, ineffective. Jamie George, similar. Daly looked undercooked. I'm not convinced whether he's even an international 15. Get him in the attacking line. Clive Woodward was saying Itoje had a good game, and I would argue with that considering the penalties he was giving away, but then he has won a World Cup and knows a little bit more about rugby than me. But I think you've got to be playing players that are in form and who are playing rugby, and someone like a Marcus Smith at Quins or Joe Simmons at Exeter, even Charlie Atkinson and Marga from Wasps, who have been in the squads recently, have to be playing over Farrell, who has been sat there doing nothing, going stiff for a couple of weeks. And how Sam Simmons in the back row isn't getting a call up to play, I have no idea. But I thought Scotland were good. I thought Redpath was good in his debut. I thought England will hopefully learn their lesson that if you keep kicking the ball away, you won't win matches. But yeah, that's possibly something to look at over the next few weeks as the Six Nations continue. But enough of that, Jimmy, because I know rugby is not your favourite thing to discuss. Jimmy, what is next?
I thought I would focus on the transfer window and the effects. Certainly the Joe Willock had on his debut for Newcastle, Jesse Lingard scoring twice on his debut for West Ham. Just having a look to see how we're rating players so far, what we're thinking, also where we think teams may need to improve in future windows. Man United's conceding another 90th minute goal, defensive howlers there. Everton's goalkeeper slipping upon diving to save a pretty regulation header. Albeit not little arms, different goalkeeper this time. So just general thoughts. I thought Willock had a pretty strong debut for Newcastle, added legs into midfield, something that we've lacked desperately. Unfortunately, you've still got Shelvey and Hendrick either side of him. So goes to show you cannot polish a shit, but certainly goes a long way towards it. Step in the right direction, I'd say. 8 out of 10.
I think from a Newcastle point of view, he probably does offer that into the middle of the park, that box to box. I know he made his comment, didn't he? He said to Saint-Maximin that if you beat the defender, you beat the fullback, cut it to the edge of the box, I'll be there and I'll finish it, which is exactly what he did do.
Oh, hindsight's whether a wonderful said, thing, knowing that.
Yeah, whether he said that legitimately or not, it certainly sounds good. And it's something that we have been missing as a team, as anyone being there other than, say, Wilson in the box. Joe Linton didn't do that. Like you say, Shelvey and Hendrick don't exactly bust a gut to get forward. So those legs in midfield make a difference. I think, again, hindsight is a beautiful thing, but they need some centre-backs now, Newcastle, and probably not bringing Lejeune back from his loan may well bite them in the arse come a couple of weeks. But
that could be the worst decision I've ever come across, by the way.
Yeah.
Letting Lejeune go out on loan. I know at the time you would have looked at it and you would have said, right, you had Lascelles, Clark, Fernandez, Shaw, Dummett, who can fill in five, that you probably rated a bit better mobility. We are so short now. It is terrifying.
Who would you have signed if at the start of January? If you obviously you wouldn't know that you had the injuries coming, but if you were going to go after a centre half,
no. To be fair, I don't know if going after a centre half is the right thing. I looked at it personally as a fan and thought our short term problem was in midfield. Shelvey wasn't covered. Hayden was. He's got decent legs and he'll get around and he'll tackle, but all of a sudden he was filling in at centre back in the few weeks before. You were playing Hendrick and Shelvey, for some reason, Matty Longstaff continues to get overlooked. Young Anderson's come in and looked okay on debut, but he's only 17, 18. You can't expect him to start. So I think the major turning point had to be getting legs in midfield, a bit of pace. So I wouldn't really know where to start with centre-backs. So I would have just said that decision to let Lejeune go out on loan now looks an absolute shocker.
I think it's not necessarily the decision from January, is it? Because even at the start of January, we had centre-backs. Just in hindsight now, when you have a bad game and you lose a few of them at once, it's a bit of a shocker. But Tinners, what do Liverpool need? Because they're obviously slipping a little bit.
I think a similar thing with they probably could have went out and do you go and break the bank a little bit in January and buy a big centre half, then he might not get used when Gomez and Van Dijk comes back. I'm not sure. I think they probably could have got better than what they've got though. I think they definitely would have had the money to go out and buy better than what they did. Well, obviously yet to see how good they are. I can't imagine they're going to be much better than Phillips and Williams that we've got already, who've come up through the academy, and obviously Phillips have played some first team football. I watched last night the Monday night football, and they did the comparison of the squads of what Liverpool have got and what other teams have got, and I think they just need competition for players all of a sudden. I think they need some. I know we've got Jota up front, and he can fill in all three positions, but then after that, they kind of know they're going to play every week. Man City players don't know they're going to play every week. They don't even play with the striker anymore, and they don't need to. And I think that's kind of what we're missing. I think the midfield, once everyone's fit, we've got enough of them. But I think we just need some competition for places up front as well. Just having that rotation factor, that means we can kind of have people fresh-legged every week. Hopefully a blip from Alisson, which we'll forget about. I don't think it was anything to do with his cold feet. I think it was just a blip, but I think we just need, like I said, competition for both places, I think.
Do you think you've just mentioned that that City obviously played without a striker of the weekend? Do you think that's what they need to go and dip in for? Should they have gone into the market for a striker themselves, almost have that true number nine, number 10?
I think they will. I can't see them not. I mean, Aguero's come to the end of his contract. Jesus obviously isn't his favourite because he doesn't score a load of goals. Will they go out and get Haaland from Dortmund? We know there's a release clause there. So I think they will do, whether or not they will this summer or whether they'll just kind of wait out a little bit and hopefully get Aguero a new contract. But I think they'd just give Dalot a go up front, let him play, change the game.
Do you think you can get Kane for cheaper than you can get Haaland?
No,
definitely not.
Inflation rates between Premier League clubs, astronomical. Yeah. When you look at some of the deals between Premier League clubs that have gone through recently.
Yeah, and Kane's English, so all of a sudden he gets an added 25 million on for no reason.
That's what they're talking about, isn't it? That English thing that they're actually almost potentially looking at, say, like Danny Ings or something like that to bring in as a striker, let him have a go at Champions League football again because his time at Liverpool was so hampered with injuries. He's scoring goals. They want that out-and-out striker. And he will obviously be a hell of a lot cheaper than Kane. But Kane, because he is proven in that league, if you're going to spend big money, they keep getting talks about going for Messi to reunite him and Pep and things like that. But do you just say, actually, we'll put all our eggs in the Kane basket and whatever it is Levy wants, who will have to still cover costs of the stadium, still has to cover costs of the squads and the wages and things there. Do you just maybe say, we'll take him off your hands? And because they can't afford to pay him, because by transfer fees, City don't spend huge amounts of money on individual players. They spend big across the board, but they don't spend masses on individual players comparative to some other teams.
Arguably, if you look at their squad,
didn't they just spend £60 million on a defender?
But that's not massive in these times. £60 million is not massive in football now.
It's kind of big.
That massive is over. It is, no, but massive. So
if you look at,
yeah, it's not
on a defender, they're spending
Neymar
that
big. I get that, but even Liverpool haven't been spending that. If you think about it,
spent 75 on Van Dijk.
Yeah, but that's only 15 more than what they've just spent on Diaz.
But I think arguably Man City have got because Jones and Diaz, Stones and Diaz have kind of come together. You look at their squad and you think they don't need to improve anywhere. And I think Foden becoming such a first-team player, I think they are just lacking that one position, which means instead of going over the board and spending £300 million on seven players, they can now just go, right, let's pay £130 million for one player. That fits our squad, like a Harry Kane, like a Haaland, and happy days. Then you look at their squad and it's even more frightening than what it is now. And I think that's probably what they'll do. I think they'll strengthen. They'll win the league this year and then they'll strengthen, I think.
There's a few teams down the bottom that probably need to buy strikers, and I don't necessarily know which strikers are the right option, I guess, out of, say, a Brighton who need to score some goals so they're not winning games by one or drawing games with just an odd goal. West Brom probably need to score goals for the amount that they're shipping at the moment. Burnley needs someone because they need to start creative. Fulham need to stop drawing as well. I know they've signed Madger, who's obviously the ex-Sunderland lad, but I'm amazed that one of these teams didn't go in for Ivan Toney even. he's obviously scoring a load in the Championship. He's been bigged up. He was bigged up massively when Brentford were playing Newcastle. And even at Adam Armstrong, he's getting talked about again as going somewhere. But none of these teams wanted to sign him in January. And I don't know if that's a sign of the times or whether it's just...
It's a sign of the times. It's a little bit off the back of COVID and everything else that's gone on, isn't it? That the number of loans that we're going through this year was a lot greater than I think's probably gone through in previous transfer windows. I mean, for a certain point, I could only remember one proper transfer. And now I'm saying it, I can't remember who it was. Oh, Villa. Villa signing that kid from Marseille for 15 million.
Yeah,
for a while, that was the only one that I could physically, well, actually mentally remember going through.
That's almost to replace Barkley when he goes back on loan as well, isn't it? Although I think with the way Chelsea are at the minute, he might be available come the summer. But
I think one of the things Jimmy mentioned at the start was the Everton goalkeeper, and I think they'll go out and strengthen. I don't think Ancelotti will be too worried about selling Pickford on. I don't think he'll be overly concerned about that.
Start playing Henderson?
They need to sort that out, by the way. I don't necessarily think De Gea is the answer anymore.
I think Henderson's good. I think Henderson's decent. I think genuinely, because he's not playing, his place at the Euros is in doubt because...
Would you cash in England, as Man United now, would you look at it and say, right, let's cash in De Gea, let's get quite a bit of money from a Madrid or someone, or someone somewhere would pay for him. We've got a decent keeper in Henderson. And then let's go and spend that cash elsewhere. Let's get a better centre-back in. Let's go and get that French lad from... Leipzig that Bayern and Chelsea and Liverpool are looking at. Let's join that race for him.
I think they could have done that genuinely when they bought Henderson back from Sheffield United in the summer. They should have done it then. And even then, his stock was higher than it is now because it's every couple of weeks they're letting themselves down in some capacity. And he's been to blame for a couple of those mistakes. But I think Henderson needs to be playing himself. I'm amazed. I know they wouldn't necessarily let him, but I'm amazed that he wasn't trying to bang on the door to get more games. If he wants to be number one at the Euros with Pickford making his mistakes and things, you've got Pope, who is a very popular keeper at Burnley. You've got Darlow is playing well at Newcastle. Like, could he be a backdoor choice for the Euros as the third choice keeper? And Henderson or Pickford, who are making mistakes, miss out? I think Pickford will still start at the Euros, but you've got options.
Pickford will start because Southgate likes what he knows. He judges a lot of his players on what they've done for England, which, unfortunately for someone like Darlow, makes it quite difficult. I don't know. I wonder if... The point that I was wondering is, if you had to pick a keeper between one of these two, would you go for Henderson or Mendy at Chelsea? I'd go Henderson personally.
I'd go Henderson also.
Yeah, I probably would as well, but just on the basis that Mendy's made a couple of mistakes as well.
If you make a mistake in goal, you get noticed a lot more. And I think that's been shown with players like Alisson recently, who's obviously made those mistakes at the weekend. No one is perfect. So I think, in essence, you'll see a lot more mistakes coming through from goalkeepers in recent weeks as more and more teams, in coming seasons, as more and more teams try and play out from the back.
One of the other signings that obviously did happen again alone, Jimmy, is to replace Ozil at Arsenal. How good a signing is Odegaard potentially going to be for them?
I'm excited about this one because there's obviously a lot of hype around him. I know nout about him. Football Manager wonder kid. Genuinely couldn't tell you what he's actually done. Had a couple of loan seasons back in the tin pot leagues in Holland and... Did he go to Denmark or something? Or Belgium?
No, he's been across Germany. He's been at Hoffenheim, hasn't he?
No, he's not been at Hoffenheim.
He played at...
I'd know about that.
Havland, wherever.
He played at Real Sociedad.
Well, that was the thing, he had a decent season at Sociedad. And then Miguel Marino stepped up to the plate since he left. But...
Heerenveen he played at.
Holland, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
sorry.
I don't know, it'll just be interesting to see how he does. The other thing that'll be interesting to see is, can he knock out Smith Rowe? He should be able to.
But
Smith Rowe's playing well.
Smith Rowe looks like a proper player, doesn't he?
I mean, he's just a kid, really. You need to give him a break every now and then. You can't expect him to be carrying that Arsenal team. Someone else has got a burden, some responsibility at some point. He could be the answer.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I think it's one of the more exciting transfers
on Saturday. This in one, the bits but... that I saw him in.
Yeah. I think it'll be a good one.
I'm not going to lie. When you opened that up, Dougie, I thought you were going to talk about Jay Lings.
No, I'm not too bothered about him. Good player for a youngster, though.
Who, Lings?
Tinners, what's next?
I've taken my headline from The Great Cricketer because I thought it was quite a good one. And it is, Joe Root is a big boy again. And we've discussed this a couple of times on our podcast. And what do we think? Is Joe Root back in the big boys now?
Root.
Well, we said he'd have to score back-to-back double hundreds like Kane Williamson. I know it wasn't quite back-to-back, but he's done all right. What I was thinking, I was trying to have this debate with one of my mates the other day. To score the volume of runs that Root has scored over the past three test matches, it's been Sri Lanka and India, what level of cricket would you have to be playing at to return those numbers?
I don't think there's a low enough level.
I think I'd just get caught trying to tee off. Oh, I'd just miss it. I don't know. No, I just don't think I'd score that many.
It is a phenomenal three test streak.
8% of his test runs have come in 2021.
Yeah.
It's a serious
effort. He's jumped from something like the eighth leading run scorer before the Sri Lanka tests to third now, is he in the UK? In England, sorry? In the UK. Yeah, oh, technically, I guess.
In the UK.
Yeah, I just think it's like you said, Doug. You couldn't even think about scoring that many runs. I mean, there'll be lads go through their whole test career and doing.
What about Neil Warnock's congratulation video to him? How good was that? Still finding a way to blame a referee decision in a video to say well done on 100 tests, Joe.
Just loves the Yorkshire lads.
Class. Fellow Blade.
What do we think, obviously, of the whole test? I haven't caught a lot of that. I've watched a lot of the highlights. And obviously, coming on now, they've just beaten India. What do we think of the test? What do you think of the team they picked? Obviously, there'll be rotation. But what do we think of the spinners?
Dom Best would not look out of place in a Village second team. He bowls 2-3 bad balls and over.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Are the spinners good enough to see out the series? I know they've gone one up. I know they have contributed in this game, but are they going to be good enough to see out a first and a third innings game where they've got to bowl, not necessarily on the pitch that's assisting them quite as much in that fourth innings? And I think from what you saw, obviously Anderson had his magic over, because I don't think there's a better reverse swing bowler in world cricket. And obviously Stokes can do it as well. And it's not bad when you've got someone like Woody being kept on the sideline who can reverse it as well. But I think the spinners, England are a frontline world-class spinner away from having a very, very good team, I think. And I don't know who the answer is, because you can't just create a spinner. And so it's probably got to be you're backing Leach and Best to come good. And I don't know how you get them to come good, but...
Is Best a little bit like what happened with Mo and Ali, that they give Mo and Ali the similar thing of lots and lots of tests, and then all of a sudden he turned into this really world-class off-spinner? Obviously, then later on into his test career, he's kind of lost it again a little bit. But is that what they're trying to do with Best? Because there's no one as a standout? Because I think Leach, at international level, especially in India, can hold his own. Obviously, Pant went after him a little bit.
It was a crack of Ali, though. Not that he was a batter who offered a little bit of off-spin. And then all of a sudden, that off-spin improved drastically. Like, I just find with Dom Best, if your go-to is your off-spin, it just needs to drastically improve. Like, it's all well and good. I actually thought he was a bit shit batting in the second innings. Maybe a lot of people will say that's unfair. I thought at a point where England were looking to score runs and you had people like Pope, Root, Butler going at some decent run rates, I thought he was just almost looking to get himself a score so that he could turn around and say, I've got another 20. I can bat as well as bowl a bit of off-spin. Maybe that's me being harsh and on him.
Do you think the pressure on him is so big? Obviously, being over in India, he's expected to take so many wickets. That's why there's a possibility he started to kind of chuck up three full tosses.
Because he did it in the UK as well, when he wasn't expected to do that. Holder absolutely
spoke him
about Southampton. He turned around and gave it the big one after eventually getting one through his gate. You just think, he's almost got this arrogance about him, which comes across, which I don't like.
played Test cricket, Jimmy. He can do what he wants. I genuinely think Joe Root is England's best spinner in that team. And I know it's a hell of a lot to ask him to score the runs he does, to captain the side and then bowl potentially 25 overs in a day. But I think he is, when he has bowled, he's A, got a knack of taking wickets, but B, I think he's got better control, certainly than Bess. I think Leach, as you say, holds up an end, but is that a threat? If he's holding up an end in the subcontinent and you're not a threat in the subcontinent, how does that make you as a spinner? I don't know, but...
I thought the one thing about Joe Root is, for an off spinner, he's got a very good leggy that I definitely couldn't pick. And you see it come out and you're thinking, where the fuck's that come from? Do you not think there's a thought of Joe Root, though, that because probably a lot of people see him come on and think part-time and they'll try and get after him? Be interesting to see how a lot of his dismissals fall as wickets. Because I wonder if a lot of them are people just trying to almost hit him out the ground.
I don't think you get that in Test cricket, though, do you? Like, unless you're bowling proper declaration bowling, you don't just suddenly go, here's a part-timer in Test cricket, I'm going to try and take him to the moon.
If anything, it's the other way. Yeah. Like, God, I'm on 80, I'm not getting out to him. I think as well, Joe, I just don't think he's backward taker. I think, say he got a double 100 in the first dig and then he had to bowl 25 overs, I think he's backward, just be shot. You've seen he cramps up, obviously. I think anyone would cramp up on however many he was on when Coley was giving him a helping hand, but I just don't think his body would take then bowling 25 overs, and I think that's probably why he's never done it before. It'd be interesting to see what the most amount of overs he's bowled in an innings is. I think they've got a couple of spinners. I mean, that Verdi every time from Surrey, who you hear him getting spoken about, everyone kind of praises him massively, but he's a genuine spinner who is obviously looking to improve his batting because he's over there always in the net. But it's one of those things that they don't like people who can just do one thing. They want you to be able to bat and bowl. So is that why Bess is getting to go over Verdi? And is that fair? Because at the end of the day, Jimmy Anderson's the best bowler, the best seam bowler there's ever been, but can't really bat. Understatement. Or doesn't score many runs.
Burnley lap.
You know what I mean?
I guess the other end of the lineup, Sibley's found a bit of a way these last few innings to score some runs up there. And what's that top three potentially going to look like with arguably five players wanting to be involved and having had a go in the last few test matches, depending on conditions? You've got Sibley, Burns, Crawley, Lawrence, Bairstow. Is Pope even up to three to potentially accommodate that middle order an option coming up? You've got Ben Foulkes maybe playing instead of Butler, with him going home in the next couple of games. He should have been playing for the last 20 test matches, but...
Foulkes should have been.
I think
Foulkes should have been. He should be captain of England by now.
As if you picked him to be leading run scorer in Sri Lanka in that first test.
He will finish as England's greatest test batsman, Ben Foulkes.
I'm not going to argue with that, actually. I'm a big fan of that as a shout. I think
he's already got one test under his name.
I think England need to start picking batters like they would pick spinners and play for conditions. So why Bairstow isn't playing in India at the minute, I'm not really too sure. I don't think Lawrence and Crawley are the answer there. As you said, Sibley's found a way. I like Burns. I just wonder when they go to Australia next year if they would stick with Lawrence and Crawley over there, or if they would potentially revert back to Bairstow, someone who's done it in Australia.
Well, that's the question that I think is potentially whether Pope goes up the order in Australia, is because I don't even know whether Bairstow is the answer in Australia with the pace on the ball, getting bounced, it coming quick at him, hands at it, moving ball. I don't know.
Would you not take Crawley to Australia and then wait at the minute? I think I'd pick Bairstow, and then obviously if Butler's going, then pick Foulkes, and I think you'd pick Bairstow at three, and then Foulkes goes straight swap for Butler. Or do you pick Butler as, obviously you're going to disagree with this, though, but you pick Butler as your wicket keeper and bat in where Butler is, and then put in a number three of Lawrence or someone else? I think you play Foulkes personally, and then you play Bairstow, but then in Australia I think Crawley gets the shout over.
I think Bairstow should be. I can't believe he's not there, especially after the India series he had now. I don't really understand the logic of it, and I don't understand, when there is a test championship to play for, why you're saying no.
One of the better players of spinner not going, and I don't understand the rest period.
He hasn't
when
played.
Joe, and Joe Root hasn't played, but then he scored loads of runs after such a long time off. Keep playing there, so it's a chance for him to prove a point, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't get it at all, but
it's interesting. It'd be interesting to see what happens when they all come back and they're all available. Do you think, will they rest Anderson for the next test and put Broad in? Will that just be a straight swap? Or do you think they'll play two?
How much do the players get a say on it? Because, like you say, if Bairstow had a say on it, he'd be playing because he was in form. If Anderson's got a say on it, and as long as his legs are all right, I don't know what the turnaround is off the top of my head, but if they've got a little bit of a rest, he's feeling good with the ball. Like, why wouldn't he? I don't think there's any reason to drop him.
No. He's not bowling millions of overs, is he? At the end of the day, he's not bowling 30, 40 overs. Every kind of like both.
How many did he bowl in the fourth innings?
Fairly low number.
Easy payday that. And I did notice he picked up a check in the award ceremony.
11 overs, 3 for 17. Thanks for coming. Have a rest next. I'll play next game, Jimmy.
And I think you say, if he can make the difference in that, like he did with that over today, then that could be the difference between you going 2-0 up or potentially coming back to 1-1. And I think if you can go 2-0 up, all of a sudden those last two tests become a bit easier.
Yeah. Well, he bowled 17 overs in the first test. First inning, sorry. So he hasn't bowled anywhere near what he normally
so would. I don't see why he's injured.
Go again.
And as you said now, I don't see why he's in Bairstow and Butler home.
No.
Well, certainly worth following.
It's probably why we're not the selectors.
Certainly worth following and seeing how they get on. But before we close for this week, in terms of our prediction, obviously Jimmy got one right. Why don't we stay Six Nations, having talked to Christoph today? Why don't we say, or make a prediction on how many points England beats Italy by in the Six Nations? Tinners, you can go first.
No. We'll just go with 10.
Jimmy?
I think it'll be narrower. I'm going to go 7. One try. Don't know why.
Against England?
Yeah.
France just put 50 points. England weren't that bad, Jimmy.
France put 50 past them.
Yeah.
Fuck me, they are terrible, aren't they? Italy. Why did they even come? Make the Five Nations again. Get rid of them. Make it more competitive.
England by 30.
Right, 20. Yeah, 25. Got to change that. Can I go?
Thought you were going to go 29 then. Just do the classic. I'll be one.
No, you can't change that. I'm taking your first answer, Jim.
Right, gentlemen, unless you've got anything more to add, it's been a pleasure as always.
As always.
Yeah, bye, lads.
Speak to you soon.
Take care.
I'm the cat with the bass and drum going around like bum, bum, bum.